tell that this character that I play has some kind of arrested development. And in a way, he was very much like I probably was at 13 or 14. And the closeness that you have with your mother and the way that you rely on each other was something I could recognize. I think that he goes off the handle a lot. But I didn't feel like I couldn't understand where he was coming from at any stage.
Actor Chris O'Dowd on playing a dysfunctional son in his new movie Love After Love. That interview is coming up later on the show. But first, 87 million Facebook users might have had their data compromised in the Cambridge Analytica scandal. The original estimate was 50 million, and you'll be able to find out if you were one of them on Monday. COO Sheryl Sandberg is making the media rounds, apologizing and emphasizing that Facebook cares about your privacy. The company released a document laying out the ways it'll protect user data. And to comb through it all, we have April Glazer on the line now. She covers tech and business for Slate. Welcome back, April.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, I just want to play a little clip of tape from Sheryl Sandberg when she spoke with Steve Inskeep on Morning Edition today, saying the company will take really firm action, she said, on protecting user data and will undertake aggressive steps on ads transparency and won't wait for federal regulators to act.
We've always had a deep responsibility for people, but at our size and scope, with billions of people using our products, we have a very deep responsibility. We're having conversations with regulators around the world, but we're not even waiting for regulation. We built a tool that shows every ad that any page is running on Facebook. It's live in Canada. It will be live in the U.S. before the election.
Okay, so that's one of several interviews she's given. What do you make of her tact? How does she come off to you?
Well, it sounds to me like she's really trying to make a point about the fact that they are getting ahead of regulators here because Facebook doesn't want to be regulated, right? You know, if I was to list an example of one of the best examples of an industry that has failed at self-regulation, it would be the online advertising industry. And we've seen through the various blunders from Facebook over the past 18 months that it has not handled user data in a responsible way and has even allowed, you know, ad targeting, be it political advertising like what she's talking about, or just any type of ad targeting, to focus on people's bigotries. Like, it wasn't until November of last year that Facebook stopped allowing advertisers to target people based on anti-Semitism or on sexist remarks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then earlier this week, the CTO, the chief technology officer of Facebook, published an update on plans to restrict data access on Facebook and gave a point-by-point description of what Facebook was undertaking. And there's one part in particular I want you to comment on. Basically, they were saying that they were going to limit the ability to search people's phone numbers or email addresses in a Facebook search, and then admits that and I'm going to just quote from this. Given the scale and sophistication of the activity we've seen, we believe most people on Facebook could have had their public profile scraped in this way. We have now disabled this feature. What is he talking about?
Well, he really buried the lead there because that comment was nestled right in the middle of the blog post. And, you know, what he's saying is that most users on Facebook have had their data scraped in some way. Now, this isn't data on your likes, or data, you know, on pages that you follow necessarily. What he's referring to in this instance is public profile data. But a lot of people set their profiles to very, very public ways. What he's saying is that most users on Facebook have been affected by people who somehow obtain lists of email addresses or phone numbers and then search Facebook with those lists. And then get somebody's profile picture, their name, and whatever other public information they may have available to enhance their kind of, you know, digital profiles of people that could be used in all kinds of malicious ways, like ad targeting or selling those profiles on that black market. So this isn't exactly the same type of data that was carted off in the Cambridge Analytica scandal that has made headlines in the past couple weeks. It's public profile data, but Facebook allowed people to match their phone numbers and pictures, kind of creating this massive online address book that people might not have consented to.
Right, and we don't even know what that information was used for. At least with Cambridge Analytica, we have an idea.
With Cambridge Analytica, we have an idea, but, you know, we've had many people who, you know, who either used to work at Facebook or people who were involved in Cambridge Analytica at the time say that they suspect most of this information is already on the black market somewhere. And there is a robust economy of people that peddle in all kinds of personal information on folks that are used in nefarious ways that we might not even be aware of that could affect us down the line.
Okay, let me bring in David Lazarus now, consumer columnist at the LA Times. Hi, David.
Hi. Hiya, Madeline.
Okay, you heard all that. Is it time to quit Facebook?
Well, I know a lot of people who have been asking me, how do you do it? And you know, obviously, you want to step carefully when you do something like that. But no, I don't think it is. I think, if anything, the takeaway from all of these current events with Facebook is that it's been a wake-up call for a lot of users that we all enter into this Faustian bargain when we go into any social media site or pretty much anything online, whether it's a Google search or Yahoo Finance or anything where they're giving you an incredibly cool service for free. And you know, what are they asking you in return? Well, they're asking for your information, obviously. We all kind of knew that when it was all new and innocent. And now that we're all a little more jaded and we've been around the block once or twice, I think a lot of people have kind of forgotten that this deal existed, and that as these services become more sophisticated and as Facebook increasingly comes to own the digital world, as, say, Yahoo or AOL did back in the Jurassic period, that we are giving up so much of our personal lives that these companies are becoming extremely empowered and extremely powerful in what they do with this data. So, again, I think the important thing that comes out of this is that we remember this and maybe think twice about what we share.
Yeah. Well, I guess we do enter this Faustian bargain, and we do know that our information is public, but I don't think most of us knew the extent to which the information would then be shared with people. We had no idea we're out there, and we had no idea what their actual priorities or intentions were, and we still don't.
And I'm with you on that. I think most people don't understand, for instance, the data mining industry and how deep it goes and what they do with it and how all of these statistics and figures and information can be parsed for political purposes, as, say, Cambridge Analytica has done, or for marketing purposes, as any number of companies are doing. And we don't really think about the level of sophistication that goes into all of that. But I think the bottom line, especially from the user perspective, is yes, we're dealing with extremely sophisticated entities that have extremely sophisticated algorithms and are doing everything they possibly can to connect the dots so that they can find out what you're buying, where you're buying, when you're buying, what you like, what you dislike. They put it all together, and you know, when you spread it all apart, you think, well, it's not going to harm me. This is just, you know, what are they going to do? But you put it all together, and you can create an aggregate profile of somebody that is so close to being spot on as to be frightening. And that's what people need to remember, is these guys know. Mm-hmm. They know about you.
And you have to be okay with that or do something else.
Yeah, or you turn into, you know, Ted Kaczynski and you live in a cabin somewhere.
Or you demand some kind of regulation and transparency.
Yeah, or as Sheryl Sandberg suggested, look, if you don't want us giving you ads and things like that, you could pay us, to which I say, yeah, there you go. In the same way that I don't like ads on TV, so I pay for HBO. I don't like ads when I'm listening to music, so I might pay for satellite radio. And this is another thing that I think people want to consider. Would you be willing to pay a premium to not have these guys looking over your shoulder?
Okay. So, April, I want to go back to you because there's this other piece of news that came out from CNBC, and they reported that Facebook was entering into a program, did not actually implement it, but they were researching it. This is a program with American hospitals to share information on patients, like so what illnesses they have, what pills they're taking, and then sort of cross-reference with their behavior online to see exactly how they could tailor their medical response to these patients. This seems like a privacy violation waiting in the wings there.
It does, because, you know, we've seen Facebook time and again not really handle user data responsibly. And, you know, even if users did agree to, you know, the terms of service when they signed up for Facebook, nobody reads through those arduous blocks of text. They just click agree and then get to what they want to do. You know, in this case of Facebook exploring the idea of linking people's medical data to their profile and anonymizing that in some way, that was just something that they were looking into. The idea is that it could have, you know, some sort of benefits down the road with helping caretakers know that, say, if somebody doesn't have a lot of friends around them in their area, you know, they could, like, link Facebook data to figure that out. But, you know, Facebook has pulled out of those agreements, they said, because, or at least those discussions, because people are probably rightfully weary of Facebook having such sensitive information on them.
Mm. Well, did they pull out of that after the Cambridge Analytica scandal?
It's report, the timeline is a bit fuzzy, but it does seem that did influence their decision to pull out of those discussions. And to be fair, Facebook probably has discussions with all kinds of data partners all the time in ways that they could link the profile information to that data. I'll just say that we actually don't understand yet exactly how pernicious or how negative the consequences of digital ad targeting really is or has been on society. I mean, we do know that during the subprime mortgage crisis, you know, the top advertisers in the country on online ads were subprime companies selling bad financial products, targeting to people online. You know, we do know that Facebook lets people target or has let advertisers target people based on their bigotries. And we're just starting to understand kind of how this type of fine-tuned advertising has manipulated or has not manipulated people. And until we really have a grasp on the effect of this type of ad targeting or this type of data collection on society, people should be wary about, you know, linking, you know, anything about their sexual history or their medical treatment information to their friends, right, yeah, who are on Facebook.
Well, so on Monday, people will have a link at the top of their news feeds to see what apps they use and what info they've been that Facebook has shared with those apps, and they'll be able to remove the apps they don't want. They'll also find out whether they were part of this Cambridge Analytica data scraping. Is that going to be enough to understand exactly what Facebook is doing with our data?
No, it's not going to be enough. I mean, it's great to provide more transparency. You know, it's great to put more tools in users' hands to make these decisions. But, you know, it's really putting the onus on users then to opt out of things or to review their own activity, right? And it's true that, like, people should have responsibility for this. But Facebook is one of the most powerful companies in the world. And they really, you know, should be acting, you know, in the interest of their customers, not just in the interest of their shareholders, even though, of course, they're going to be doing that. And, you know, do what they can to make sure that people are going to be safe, not just giving people more information so that way they can have an understanding of something that they probably aren't really going to fully grasp anyway.
David, what's your opinion of that?
Well, I think April's right about all that stuff, but I think the real takeaway from what we're seeing as Zuckerberg and Sandberg, you know, make the rounds and try and put their spin on it is that, yes, they're introducing more transparency, and yes, they're trying to stay ahead of regulation, but the bottom line is they haven't announced anything yet that is going to scale back data usage. And, of course, that's their bread and butter. That's where the money is. And if they were to announce anything along those lines, there could be a material hit to their share value, because, obviously, if you're an investor in Facebook, you don't want to see them doing anything that's going to give them less leverage over this vast trove of data that they collect on users. So I think it's very telling that for all their moves on transparency and we're your friend and we take privacy seriously, they're not announcing anything that says, yeah, we understand that we're stewards of your information and we're going to be better stewards of your information by not sharing it, by making it harder for people to get at it. No, they're not saying that at all.
David Lazarus, consumer columnist for the LA Times. April Glazer covers tech and business for Slate. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, why EPA Chief Scott Pruitt wanted a bulletproof desk, among other fancy items, and why his many ethical questions may not be enough to get him fired. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Things are not looking good for EPA Director Scott Pruitt, who is mired in a growing list of ethics scandals. News broke today that President Trump's chief of staff, John Kelly, told the president last week that Pruitt should go, that he should fire him. That recommendation would have come before a New York Times report yesterday that at least 5 EPA officials were sidelined after they questioned Pruitt's spending habits. and before details emerged about two Pruitt staffers who received massive raises through an obscure provision in the Safe Drinking Water Act. Pruitt is also under fire for a pretty sweet rental deal on a condo owned by the wife of an energy lobbyist. Here to talk about all this is Aaron Blake. He's senior political reporter for the Washington Post's political analyst blog, The Fix. Hi.
Good afternoon.
Okay, so walk us through the last week or so of all of these ethical stories, because, I mean, we've known for a while that there was a first-class travel habit that wasn't particularly welcomed in the White House and some security requests, but things seem to really pick up this week.
Yeah, they've really snowballed, and it really began, I would say, with the lease agreement that was $50 per night, only on nights that he was staying at the condo and was at a condo that was owned by the wife of an energy lobbyist, somebody who represents companies like ExxonMobil, like Cheshire Energy, somebody with very significant interests in what things the EPA administrator might be overseeing. That's led to a series of developments. The administrator says that the arrangement was signed off on by ethics officials at the EPA. We're finding more and more that that's not exactly the case. They signed off on the market value of the rental, but they haven't signed off on the people it was from, the energy lobbyist family. And then there's been other controversies, most especially the staffers who are exiting, as you mentioned, from the New York Times piece, and then also a situation in which Scott Pruitt was asking for significant raises for a couple staffers who had been with him since he came from Oklahoma. But the White House had not agreed to those raises, and so they were obtained by other means. They were obtained by a somewhat obscure provision in what's called the Safe Drinking Water Act that allowed them to get significant raises, even as the White House had turned them down for those. So it seems to be kind of a collection of things that have really grown in the past week or so here, and have led to lots of questions about how careful Scott Pruitt was, whether he was acting ethically, and whether the White House is going to stick with him.
Okay, let me play some clips of him trying to defend himself. Here he is on Fox talking about the raises that he gave those two aides.
So hang on. Both of these staffers who got these large pay raises are friends of yours, I believe, from Oklahoma, right?
They are staffers here in the agency.
Then they're from they're friends of yours.
Well, they serve a very important person.
And you didn't know that they got these large pay raises?
I did not know that they got the pay raises until yesterday.
Okay, one of them got a pay raise of, let's see, $28,000. The other was $56,000. Do you know what the median income in this country is?
No.
$57,000 a year.
Okay.
So one of your friends from Oklahoma got a pay raise that's the medium income.
They did not get a pay raise. They did not get a pay raise.
They did.
No, they did not.
Okay, so what's happening there? Did they get a pay raise? How did he get this money through when the White House said, no, do not give them a pay raise?
Well, it sounds like they didn't actually go through. The pay raises were obtained or were sought last month, so there hasn't been a whole lot of time. Perhaps they didn't actually go into effect, and that seems to be what he's relying upon. But I think it's worth pointing out that in that interview, he expressed on multiple occasions that he was unaware of those pay raises, that he didn't know about them. Well, we have sources here at the Washington Post who have told us that that he was responsible for asking for those pay raises. So he may argue that he wasn't involved in the process throughout, but he certainly had at least some knowledge of the situation. And it really, you know, goes back to the question of how forthcoming he's being about this entire affair.
Let me play another clip from that interview. And this is him explaining his living arrangements, this $50 a night rental agreement he had with a condo owned by the wife of an energy lobbyist.
I was living out of a suitcase when I transitioned to Washington, D.C. My wife was not with me. My children were not with me. My dog was not with me.
But every cabinet secretary comes here.
No, but
and they're living out of a suitcase. But they rent an apartment at the actual rate.
Yeah, this is the actual rate. And that's what the ethics officials said. So and let me say this to you.
Rent Jungle is a website that looks at that. And the average rent in Washington is over $2,000 a month.
Not for what
You're
I rented.
$50 a
not
night.
For what I rented. Not for what I, this was like an Airbnb situation.
All right. And then didn't he say also that this energy lobbyist didn't have any business with the EPA, so it wasn't an ethical lapse?
Yeah, it's I think that he's choosing his words carefully there. I think that there perhaps were no specific cases dealing with ExxonMobil and with Cheshire Energy that were pending before the EPA. But that's not the same thing as saying that the decisions that have been made by the EPA, which, by the way, under Scott Pruitt, in a lot of cases have been towards deregulation. That's maybe the biggest impact that he's had on the agency. That doesn't mean that those decisions don't accrue to the benefit of companies like ExxonMobil that this lobbyist do represent. So there may not have directly been any business in front of Scott Pruitt that this lobbyist was involved in, but that doesn't mean that there couldn't have been something that was favorable happening towards them.
Okay, so meanwhile at the White House, John Kelly basically told the president to fire Pruitt, and he's not doing it. He's really publicly supporting Pruitt. Yesterday, he told reporters that Pruitt's doing a fantastic job. Why is he standing by him?
Well, I think if you compare this to other cabinet secretaries, cabinet-level officials that have been fired by the president, there in some cases have been ethical questions, even travel questions, just like Scott Pruitt has. That was certainly the case with Tom Price, who was head of HHS. It was certainly the case with David Shulkin, who was dismissed just last week from Veterans Affairs. But I think in both cases, there was a policy reason to get rid of those secretaries. There was the failure to replace Obamacare. And then with Secretary Shulkin, there was perhaps a push towards some kind of privatization of the VA that David Shulkin was opposed to. In this case, Scott Pruitt is very much on the same wavelength as President Trump, both policy-wise and kind of with their attitude towards wrecking shop in Washington, towards getting rid of regulations. And I think if anything, that's his saving grace right now. That's the thing that's going to cause President Trump to dig in and perhaps not get rid of him as quickly as he otherwise might have. The fact is that Scott Pruitt, probably with the exception of Betsy DeVos as education secretary, is the guy in this administration who makes liberals' eyes bulge out. And I think that there is something that the president likes about that. It's something he commiserates with, it's something that he associates with. And so that's led him maybe to hold out a little bit longer in this case and see if Pruitt can weather the storm.
Aaron Blake is senior political reporter for the Washington Post's political analysis blog, The Fix. Aaron, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, new movies this week include the girl-centric raunch comedy Blockers and a thriller that stars Joaquin Phoenix as a traumatized veteran.
I think this is maybe even a masterpiece. I'm absolutely, I'm not going to say I'm enamored of it because it hurt me, but it hurt me in a way that really made me think.
Movie reviews next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday, so that means it's time for movie reviews this week. Something for nearly everyone. There's a female-driven raunch comedy, a historical drama, a couple of thrillers. William Bibbiani is here. He co-hosts the podcasts Canceled Too Soon and Critically Acclaimed. Welcome back.
Hello.
And joining us, Jacqueline Coley. She's here, too. She contributes to BlackGirlNerds.com and film correspondent for Rotten Tomatoes. Welcome back to you.
So glad to be back.
Great to have you both. Okay, first up, a comedy about three girls who make a pact to lose their virginity on prom night. Their parents want to block them from doing that.
Just going through the laundry, found these new thongs.
You know I love it when the music's loud, but come and strip that down for me.
Tonight, I'm tearing these off with my teeth like an old school cartoon billy goat.
Honey, Mitch, those are your daughters.
Prom night!
Prom night!
I'm ready. You look beautiful.
I used to hold that girl in the palm of my hand.
Kayla's becoming a woman. You're going to have to deal with that.
Okay, that's Leslie Mann there. John Cena's in that. And Jacqueline, this is directed by a woman in the sort of bridesmaids-ish vein. What did you think?
Yeah, definitely. This is Kay Cannon, and she actually wrote the Pitch Perfect series, and then she's taking her directorial debut on this film, which is really funny. I actually had a good time laughing at it. Don't think too hard on this one. This is definitely not going to reinvent the wheel, but it does take something which I think could have been perhaps a very like boring cliche, and it subverts it a little bit. And I will say, Geraldine, I'm going to say her name wrong.
Vijnawathan?
Thank you.
Wow. I think that's right. I'm not 100%.
I appreciate. She's definitely the breakout of this, playing John
Cena. She plays
Cena's,
one of the girls.
Yeah, John Cena's daughter. Yeah, it's really hilariously funny.
She is to blockers what like Tiffany Haddish was to Girls Trip.
Very
it's like
much
it's
so.
An ensemble and everyone's good in it, but wow, she's going to be huge. Yeah. She's fantastic.
Yeah. So what is the general plot here?
Well, the general plot is there are three girls. They're going on their big prom night, and they all intend to, for their own reasons, lose their virginity, and for them it's going to be a big bonding moment. And their parents, who are, you know, overprotective parents for the most part, find out about this sort of surreptitiously and decide to do everything in their power in order to rooster block them. And that's the problem with the movie for me. It's very funny and the cast is really, really good. You know, that concept is so, you know, dated and kind of sad that, yeah, I think the movie ultimately takes a stance against it. But when your protagonists are doing something that's just so controlling and kind of, you know, kind of gross if you think about it, that you don't
have
the
parents.
The parents, they don't have my sympathy for a lot of it. And that's a problem. It's not the biggest problem in the world because ultimately it's a broad comedy and it's very funny.
Yeah.
So there's a couple of things I don't think work about it, a couple of scenes that maybe fall flat. But overall, the cast is so good that I'm willing to forgive a couple of quibbles. Yeah.
Now, what about this idea that that them wanting to give up their virginity is done in a pretty cavalier manner?
I mean, there's like three, there's the three female protagonists as far as the reasons for their motivation for losing their virginity. One of them, Geraldine's character, is very cavalier about it. She's made a lot of the promotional materials about it, but there's more to it than that, not to spoil it. But I would just say, like, just think of the bad concept. They kind of veer away from that. There's a lot of places that this film could have gone that would have been very sexist, misogynistic, and I just feel like they were able to thread a very difficult needle very well for this and make it funny.
If you compare this to American Pie, which has a very similar plot, American Pie was very much about the commodification of sexuality. And nowadays it plays really gross, even if some scenes are still funny. This feels like almost like a very intelligent, well-reasoned update of that basic concept into something that's a lot more palatable and a lot more likable.
And that's
intelligent.
They had five writers on this. I will go ahead and put it out there. It took a while for them to get, I think, the swing to work. And then again, with the director also being a writer and a female, I'm pretty sure she also put that through the female gaze to also make sure that as much as possible, it stood up to that scrutiny. And again, very difficult to do.
Okay, moving on to something totally different. This is a drama about Senator Ted Kennedy's involvement in a fatal accident, which killed a young campaign strategist. Her name was Mary Jo Kopechne. And here's a clip.
I was driving.
A story like this could dominate the headlines for weeks.
Chief, we got a body.
A dead body holds a lot of secrets. Those can be the difference between guilt and innocence. So we need to be in control of them. There's not a lot of senators that are charged with manslaughter that go on to become president.
Okay, so this, Jacqueline, you saw this one, is based on the true story of this incident in Chappaquiddick when Kennedy's car ran off the bridge near Martha's Vineyard. He didn't report the accident for a while. Mary Jo died, and...
Yeah, so, I mean, basically with Chappaquiddick, it's trying to tell the behind-the-scenes stories of whatever happened at Martha's Vineyard that weekend and then sort of the aftermath of the Kennedys as far as their involvement, what they knew when, and essentially what happens. And in the film, it does pretty lean towards what they think is the actual sequence of events based off of their research. It's not based off of, I would say, any kind of actual interview accounts, but it tries to tell that tale. And I think it doesn't paint the Kennedys in the best light. Let's put it that way. Obviously, with the woman died, I think a lot of people are still answering the questions from that night. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I mean, is it good drama? Is it worth seeing? Should we just read the Wikipedia entry?
Oh, yeah, I would say this one's kind of a Wikipedia entry one. This is not the best, I would say, effort, but it's pretty accurate to what I think people wanted to see. I would say a History Channel doc would be just as good.
Okay. All right. You Were Never Really Here. That stars Joaquin Phoenix as a traumatized veteran who chases down missing girls for a living. Here's a clip.
State Senator Albert Vatto. His teenage daughter's missing.
What's the lead?
You got an anonymous text with an address.
I've heard of these places. They said you were brutal.
I can be.
I want you to hurt them.
Okay, William, you saw this one written and directed by Lynn Ramsey, who did We Need to Talk About Kevin. Similarly creepy?
Creepy, yes, but I would say similarly emotionally devastating. This is one of the most take it home with you, let it simmer, question whether or not there's any good in the world, what should we do, kind of films I've seen in a while. On the surface, this is a rather pulpy storyline. It's about a girl who goes missing, a guy who goes into a deep, dark world of criminality in order to get her out, and then there's twists. And it's not really about any of that plot, though. It is about the emotional scars that all of these horrible incidents leave on their victims, and also people like Joaquin Phoenix, who just experiences and deals with terrible things for a living. And the impact that that has on him is incredibly overpowering. It is a fantastic performance from Joaquin Phoenix, and honestly, Lynn Ramsey's direction takes what could have been just a pretty good thriller and transforms it into something, honestly, something so much more. I am still kind of unpacking it. I think this is maybe even a masterpiece. I'm not going to say I'm enamored of it because it hurt me, but it hurt me in a way that really made me think and really made me question not only the emotions and the experiences of the characters, but honestly just the genre and how we sort of cavalierly accept people in action movies or thrillers and they are part of acts of violence and then they just flippantly go about their day. I don't think we can do that. This is a movie that very much challenges that. I'm fascinated by it.
So there have been comparisons to Taxi Driver. Are those apt?
I would say a little bit, but Taxi Driver, you know, the protagonist is honestly more the villain here. I think Joaquin Phoenix's character is a much more openly tragic character. I think he'll have your sympathy a bit more than Travis Bickle does. But when it comes down to the way that it illustrates his very troubled state of mind and challenges you, I think you're going to get something special out of this.
Okay, last up, A Quiet Place, directed by John Krasinski of The Office fame. He stars alongside his real wife, Emily Blunt. There is not a lot of dialogue in this thriller with the tagline, "If they hear you, they hunt you."
Who are we if we can't protect them? We have to protect them.
When there's sound, it's so terrifying. I love this movie so much.
So how much talking is in it?
I would say there's a good 30% of this movie that's near silent.
Oh, I would say, in terms of dialogue, I would say, honestly, even more than that. Like, it's the way this is not a silent movie. This movie uses sound very, 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 very cleverly. When you know that any noise is going to bring about not just death and destruction, but also from the audience perspective, a boo scare.
Yeah.
Every single thing that happens is potentially the scariest thing in the world. As an experiment in horror, this is an exceptional and very fun thriller. But on top of that, I think it's just a very good movie with excellent characters. The concept maybe doesn't hold up to scrutiny like 48 hours later as you're thinking about it. Wait a minute.
You have to suspend a little disbelief, obviously.
Right.
But they do a great job.
Because if they can hear heartbeats, well.
Exactly. Mm. And they try to do a good job of setting up this world. The one thing I will say that doesn't get talked about enough is the opening scene of this film is probably one of the best as far as setting the landscape of the film. You know exactly what the world is. You know how dangerous it is. And they completely captivate the audience in before the opening title shot. It's amazing.
Well, and beyond that, you're watching this with like a crowd and an audience. You know, if you get to see this in a theater, which I highly recommend doing, and you realize at this opening scene, there's no music, there's no dialogue, there's hardly any sound effects. Everyone in the audience, you realize how loud a movie theater is. And then you realize everyone around you is realizing how loud they're being without realizing it. And you slowly listen to the whole theater quiet down so that we can all appreciate the movie. It's a very primal. Like, yes. When something scary is happening, you trained yourself not to make a noise, you know, to sort of hide. And that's the whole movie, basically.
And the fact that it's a family, primal. The family part, I think, really adds to
and
that.
And then she's pregnant and has to give yes. birth in
yeah.
silence.
And
that's scary.
That scene alone from the trailer of her, like, not wanting to scream, and you can tell, like, she can't make noise, but she's giving birth. That, watching that on screen is beyond scary. And also, you're just, like, on the edge of your seat. I can't advise enough for people to see it.
I'm a little incredulous that could ever happen.
It works.
And then how do you keep the baby quiet?
Well,
they talk about that. We're not going to
well.
Ruin that, but they have a plan.
I'm not saying that it's, I mean, I don't know.
That's the thing, it's refrigerator logic. When after the movie is over and you're in the moment and you don't question anything, afterwards you're like, wait a minute, why didn't anyone try that before? Or
yeah.
why isn't this a thing? And you realize there's really no good reason, but it's just a monster movie and a very good one.
And you're
one.
Willing to suspend disbelief.
It's well told. I don't care about any of those details. I just don't. It's a really fun watch.
And Emily Blunt, we haven't even talked about her.
Oh my
her
God.
Acting in this is absolutely phenomenal. She's told the story. We actually got to chat with her at South By about why she took the role. Because when he was writing it, John co-wrote it, she was like, oh, well, you know, give it to this person. She read it and she was like, you can't give it to anyone else. I want to have it. And it became like this thing where she felt immediate ownership because it was that good. And I do think it is that good. It's getting good buzz for a reason.
Yeah.
Okay, so some good ones to see this week.
Yeah, honestly, a really
Finally.
Good weekend overall.
Even Chappaquiddick, which again is a History Channel doc on the big screen, it's not boring. If you like that kind of stuff, you're going to have a good time, I think, with it. So,
all right, Jacqueline, if you like that kind of stuff. Okay.
I shouldn't say it like that.
If you'll like it, you'll like it.
I mean, look, if you want to see what happened to the Kennedys, you'll enjoy it.
Yeah.
Okay, no shortage of stories about the Kennedys for sure.
Yeah.
Jacqueline Coley contributes to blackgirlnerds.com and is film correspondent for Rotten Tomatoes. William Bibbiani co-hosts the podcasts Cancel Too Soon and Critically Acclaimed. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the actor who played the nice guy cop in Bridesmaids is here, Chris O'Dowd, whose current role is definitely not nice. He's here next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Chris O'Dowd is known for playing the nice guy. You might remember him as the friendly Irish cop in Bridesmaids, Kristen Wiig's love interest. But in the new film, Love After Love, O'Dowd's character is dealing with the death of his dad. And in his grief, he lashes out at the people he loves most, namely all the women in his life, including his mom, who's played by Andie MacDowell. The film is a meditation on grief and loss. It debuted at Tribeca and comes out in theaters today. And Chris O'Dowd is here with me in the studio. Hello.
Hello there. How are you? Thank you for having me.
Well, great to have you. Okay, so this focuses on one kind of sprawling family and how they deal with the death of the patriarch, the dad in the family. And,
that's right.
And how it all comes apart. Your character seems particularly difficult.
He certainly deals with the loss the worst. He's ill prepared to be a patriarch of a family because he's definitely has stunted emotional growth. I think he sees when his father dies as a time when he will somehow be the man in the family, and he's not capable of such a thing. So he lashes out, presumably because he feels his mother has let him down in some way.
Hmm. And do we know how his mother lets him down or has let him down?
I mean, I'm not convinced that she has, but I think from his point of view, he somehow sees himself as the new patriarch. And when his mother kind of dismisses that by going back into the dating pool, he feels somehow not cuckolded, but diminished. And he doesn't know how to deal with it.
Well, it's interesting that you said cuckolded, because there's a strong undercurrent, and I don't think I'm the only one to see this,
sure,
of what seems like attraction between him and his mother.
Yeah, it's certainly an unconventional mother son relationship. It's I would stop short at saying it's incestuous, but there is certainly something unusual about it. There are scenes of them kind of lying together, and they're very tactile with each other. And so when she starts dating again, I think it freaks him out. I think there's a jealousy there. And like I say, he's kind of incapable of dealing with it emotionally, so he lashes out.
And there's a scene where they're all at a dance and he's watching his mother dance with her new boyfriend. And he can just see your character just filled with rage.
Yeah, everything is kind of comes to a T there, I guess, where he tries to make his mother jealous by, not to give too much away, but by sleeping with one of her colleagues. which, when I say it out loud, definitely sounds weird.
Sounds a little weird, yeah.
So I think it's part of the grieving process for everyone to do something slightly irrational. I think in our film, we certainly go on the broader side of irrational at times.
Let's hear a scene when he loses it, and it's at a dinner, and this dinner is a family dinner. It's supposed to be a nice dinner where her new boyfriend and his son are in attendance, and your character, Nicholas, has had a bit too much to drink.
I just want to say a little something. In honor of our new guest, happy birthday, Michael. We're very happy to have you here. Very happy.
Thank you.
To Michael and to this special thing that's happening right before our eyes, even though we're desperately trying not to notice, it is. And I think it's right that we celebrate that. So to Michael and Ma.
Cheers.
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 You're here.
You want to say something, Michael?
You don't have to say anything.
I think you're doing great. Thank you.
Nothing?
It's enough, Nicholas.
It's hard to know, isn't it? It's hard to know what to say.
Stop!
You're so selfish.
Nick.
You're so
Nick!
Shut up. Wait. Let her go! Nick, you should have asked. You should have asked.
Don't do it!
Wait!
Okay, and then there's some physical altercation there. Boy, that was long and uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's a very tense movie. And I mean, it's very... we all come from complicated families. And some are more so than others. I think what we hope to do in this is to kind of present a collage of different grieving experiences rather than a clean kind of linear look at how the stages of grief are surpassed. And it is ugly and it is brutal at times and irrational. And what I've noticed with people who have seen the movie is that even though it's unusual and they feel a little bit put out, they can relate.
Mm-hmm. He, though, seems to have had these issues before his dad died.
Sure. This was not a well put together guy before.
Yeah, exactly. And this just sent him over the edge.
I think that's right. I think he had probably always an unusual relationship with his mother. And that can happen with sons and mothers. Sometimes if a mother feels that the father figure isn't around a lot, she can rely very heavily on sons in the family. Mm. I know that happened with me.
It happened with you and your mom?
Sure. My dad was more a workaholic than anything else. And so your mother does rely on you a lot, particularly as a marriage is breaking down or things like that.
And what did your dad do?
He was a sign writer. So he did like pub signs and things like that. But in a way, it didn't. He loved it, but I think he would have been a workaholic, whatever he had done.
And this was in Ireland?
Mm-hmm.
And your mom stayed home and...
Yeah, she did until I was kind of 12 or 13. And then she went back to college and became a therapist.
She wanted to figure things out.
Mm. I guess so. I'm sure she'll let me know.
Well,
soon.
How did that affect you, being so relied upon by your mom at such a young age?
I think I felt older before I was. So I don't know if I was very much a teenager at any stage, really. I think I went straight from being an adolescent to being an adult.
So did you ever regress and have your adolescence later?
Going through it right now. It's going great. I could have lived without the whole puberty thing, but here you go.
And so are you still close with your mom?
Very much so, yeah. Yeah, and both of them. And we're a very close family. I think it was more, for us, it was just more a period in time than that's our whole relationship. I think we got past it.
And did you draw on that at all when you were doing this role?
Sure. I mean, the closeness that you feel with a mother, for me, it was, there's actually, I haven't really thought about this, but now that you bring it up, it is interesting that you can tell that this character that I play has some kind of arrested development. And in a way, he was very much like I probably was at 13 or 14. And the closeness that you have with your mother and the way that you rely on each other was something I could recognize. I think that he goes off the handle a lot. But I didn't feel like I couldn't understand where he was coming from at any stage.
It's also a little distracting that Andie MacDowell is your mom. I mean, she's beautiful. And
you mean that she looks young?
And she looks young.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. She's very beautiful.
I mean, is that casting choice done on purpose to sort of underscore the sexual tension between the two?
Yeah, maybe. Also, I think I just look a lot older than I am. And it looks a little younger than she is. But there are certainly people who have remarked that it wouldn't have been that weird if we had been dating.
Like I was expecting something.
And maybe that will be the next movie. You know, we'll have to see.
And so, and also the way that it's shot, it felt a little Altman-esque in terms of the kind of chaotic dinner scenes and the talking over each other. Was that something that you guys did extemporaneously, or was it pretty much all planned and scripted out?
A little bit of both. We would certainly roll quite a long time before and after the dialogue that we needed to capture. And those are really fun to shoot because you didn't feel like you were being captured. You just felt like you were existing and somebody was hopefully getting it from somewhere.
There's also a pretty outrageous scene where your brother in the movie gets really, really drunk.
Yes.
And then has to go to the bathroom and doesn't make it to the bathroom.
Yeah. I mean, it's James Adomian plays my brother and he's fantastic in it. And his way of dealing with grief, I guess, is to revert to childhood in a much more basic way. He becomes very messy. He starts drinking a bit and he does relieve himself at the engagement party that I'm having. I get engaged in the movie. And that turns obviously into just a real mess.
A disaster.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how did you shoot that?
Are you asking about the pee?
I'm just asking
chaos. he's a very dedicated actor, so I think he just did it. I can tell what you're trying to get at. I think he just used his willy.
Real method acting right there. You know,
again, not verified.
I have to say, this is changing subject, you look a lot like my nephew.
Oh.
I mean, I have to take pictures.
He's a model
of you.
Or?
Well, he's 12.
Good. So my moisturizer is working.
You guys have very similar faces.
Oh.
Anyway, it's a compliment.
He's got a long road ahead. Good luck to him.
Okay, so as I said in the intro, you are known for these kind of lovable types. Is this a break for you, a different route for you? Is this something that you're pursuing now as kind of a more complicated character,
I think I'm probably looking for characters with a few more dimensions to them, all right? I don't mind what kind of genre it is or if it's a nice person or a bad person or any of that kind of thing. But for the last few years, I've just been trying to deal with characters who felt like they weren't two-dimensional.
And you're here now.
Yes.
Acting mainly here in the United States.
Yes. Yes, I'm here in the United States of America.
But you're not going back to Britain or...
No, I kind of go back to Ireland and to London maybe twice, three times a year with the family and do all of that. But we're here now looking at schools and all that kind of nonsense.
And perfecting your American accent.
Trying. You guys talk weird. So...
Chris O'Dowd, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks so much for having us. I'm a big fan.
Chris O'Dowd, speaking about the new film, Love After Love. It's out in theaters now. And that's it for Press Play this week. Our show, directed by Sarah Sweeney. Our producers, Amy Ta, Michelle Aloy, Gina Pollack, Yael Evan Orr, and Jenna Cagle. Quinn O'Toole is our managing producer. Phil Richards and Mario Saavedra engineered for us. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a fantastic weekend. I'll see you on Monday.